ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. In this week's episode, I'm joined by guest and critic William Bibbiani as we sail alongside Cary Grant and Deborah Carr in the 1957 romantic drama, An Affair to Remember.
Here at 20th Century Fox Studio, Cary Grant, Deborah Carr, and director Leo McCary discuss their newest production, An Affair to Remember. If you've ever been in love or ever hope to be in love, here's a story you'll love with all your heart. Told with all the warmth and tenderness of Leo McCary's Going My Way and his Bells of St. Mary's.
In 1939, director Leo McCary made Love Affair, the simple story of two strangers who meet on an ocean liner and fall in love, despite having significant others of their own waiting for them on shore. The film starred Charles Boyer and Irene Dunne, with a script by Delmer Daves and Donald Ogden Stewart. Leo McCary was no stranger to highly charged romances, with his past films including The Bells of St. Mary's and Make Way for Tomorrow leaving audiences weeping just 2 years previously. And I can attest, Make Way for Tomorrow will make you believe in the power of love, and will also utterly destroy you. Love Affair received widespread recognition upon release, and 6 Academy Award nominations. Unfortunately, it didn't win any. I don't know if you guys know this, but 1939 was a pretty big year in film, and the story of two people talking on an ocean liner didn't do a whole lot to best the story of two people talking on a southern plantation during the Civil War. But Leo McCary couldn't get the film out of his mind, and nearly 20 years later, he would attempt to remake it.
I changed my table to a table for one.
So did I.
Now, isn't that a shame? After that delightful dinner we had together last night.
And do you speak Gaelic?
Fluently.
How do you say let's get out of here?
It's been said that director Leo McCary decided to remake Love Affair after being unhappy with it the first go-round. This in spite of its success both critically and commercially. He'd always envisioned the film as starring Cary Grant, who had been in McCary's The Awful Truth 2 years before. In essence, Grant and Irene Dunne, the two stars of The Awful Truth, would have been re-teamed for Love Affair. Unfortunately, Grant was making Gunga Din at the time, so that left Dunne to star in Love Affair with Charles Boyer, an actor McCary wasn't too keen on due to the French actor's fledgling English. When Grant became available in 1957, McCary snapped him up to star as big dame hunter Nicky Ferranti in this remake. McCary also snagged Deborah Carr as Terry McKay. Carr was a hot commodity after the recent success of The King and I, which had come out just the year previously. The final product would be a near shot-for-shot remake of the 1939 film, complete with McCary's penchant for improvised takes. Much of the film, despite Dave's and Ogden Stewart's credit, was centered around Grant and Carr simply talking to each other and letting the cameras roll around them.
Now listen carefully.
Yes.
If everything goes right, and
yes.
I mean for both of us, in 6 months, here, I started to write it out.
Should I read it now? All right. Darling, that's me?
Mm-hmm.
You have a date, my beloved, July the 1st at 5 o'clock. But you don't say where.
Well, you name the place and I'll obey.
I don't know. I can't think. How about the top of the Empire State Building?
Oh, yes, that's perfect. It's the nearest thing to heaven we have in New York.
With any remake, there's always debate about which version is better. This incarnation was nominated for fewer Oscars than its 1939 counterpart. Where the original received nods in Best Picture and for its actors, the 1957 remake only received nominations for cinematography, costumes, and its music. In fact, it is the music that puts both movies on equal footing. Love Affair's song Wishing was a popular song the summer of the film's release, and 1957's An Affair to Remember, Our Love Affair, performed by Vic Damone, became a jazz standard. Both movies did incredibly well upon release, although I'd give the edge to this one in terms of being the better known of the two.
It was nobody's fault but my own. I was looking up. It was the nearest thing to heaven. You were there. Oh, darling, don't worry, darling. If you can paint, I can walk. Anything can happen.
An Affair to Remember certainly did well for Cary Grant's rating as an actor. It was the second of three films that he'd release in 1957 and carry him well into the 1960s before his persona started to wane. This is probably one of Deborah Carr's best-known roles, even though it was the second film she made in 1957 as well. The feature was remade in 1994, starring real-life couple Warren Beatty and Annette Bening, with Katharine Hepburn in her final film role, but it was a commercial and critical flop. The movie has entered the popular culture, though, more specifically, becoming the inspiration for the 1993 Tom Hanks Meg Ryan romance, Sleepless in Seattle. After the break, critic William Bibbiani and I go in-depth into An Affair to Remember.
Our love affair is a wondrous thing that we'll rejoice in remembering. Our love torn out of time and space.
Okay, listeners, our main discussion today, we are talking about the Leo McCary romantic drama An Affair to Remember, and I am joined by the stellar film critic, podcaster, all-around awesome person, William Bibbiani. William, how are you today?
I'm adequate, thank you. No, I'm kidding. I'm really excited to talk to you. We don't get to talk a lot about classic cinema in the popular culture, and this is a wonderful excuse to delve right into that wonderful, wonderful lake of goodness.
And you are all over the internet. You're one of several of my favorite people that's talking about films today. So,
oh, that's nice.
For people who don't know who you are, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
My name is William Bibbiani. Everyone calls me Bibbs. I am a film critic working in Los Angeles, California. I am the head critic for CraveOnline.com. I also do YouTube appearances on the Young Turks Network on their What the Flick Entertainment show, where I review TV and review movies. And I also have two podcasts. There's the B-Movies podcast, in which we review movies, talk about movie news, interview filmmakers, and also Cancel Too Soon, in which we review television series that lasted only one season or less, because the history of television is actually mostly a history of failure, and most shows don't last, and then are just completely forgotten for forever. So that's a lot of fun, rediscovering a bunch of stuff that's been completely forgotten. And on top of that, I also compete on the Movie Trivia Schmodown, which I know some people enjoy. It's a movie trivia game show with elements of wrestling, so there's drama behind the scenes. Do other stuff as well. I've been on KCRW, been published in Fangoria. I try to stay busy.
You are everywhere. And for people who listen to the podcast regularly and know about my love of Ben Mankiewicz, you've been on the same show as him. You do What the Flick. I did not put you on the show because you association with him, but everybody who listens to the podcast knows I love him.
Ben is great. Ben is wonderful. And even though he's super friendly, I'm always a little intimidated just by being around him. I'm like, oh God, he introduces the movies. He's directly related to these movies. So what am I in comparison?
You and I are talking about Cary Grant, Deborah Kerr. I was going to say Irene Dunne. I almost forgot that we weren't talking about the other version of this movie. We are talking about 1957's An Affair to Remember. In case you don't know the plot of the movie, this is directed by Leo McCary, written by Delmer Daves. The plot is fairly simple. Cary Grant and Deborah Carr meet on a boat, fall in love, and vow to meet up again in 6 months at the Empire State Building. But the ultimate will they or won't they? You actually suggested this movie, and I just watched this recently for the first time. I've seen this twice now because I rewatched it for the recording.
Well, you'd never seen this before doing this podcast? That's incredible to me.
Actually, I had never seen this up until April. So
wow.
I watched it for the first time in April, and then I watched it again for the podcast today. So this is the second time I've seen it. But it wasn't until this year that I had actually taken the time to watch it. This movie just, it's dazzling to watch. It's beautifully composed. Leo McCary is a director that knows the power of the feels. Everything about this movie, even though it's been bastardized and borrowed from other movies in pop culture now, it's still got something that is just so ephemeral and different that I was very happy to talk about this, but you suggested it. What does it mean to you?
Well, there's a couple of different things. First off, I suggested it because it turns 60 this year, and always a good excuse. In fact, it actually only just turned 60 years old on July 2nd. But also, it's a film that I used to watch with my mom a lot. My mother is a big part of the reason why I do what I do. She was a big classical movie snob. She sat me down and made sure we watched every single movie from the classic section at our local video stores. As a matter of course, the way that you're supposed to read Romeo and Juliet, or watch Romeo and Juliet, or the way you're supposed to read The Scarlet Letter, you had to watch An Affair to Remember, you had to watch Citizen Kane, you had to watch the Hitchcock movies. So this was one that was very special to us. It's one of her favorite movies. And it's one that I was always very, very fond of. And I think, for me, the big reason, especially thinking back on it, on the memories I have of this, because I revisited it recently and I had a slightly different reaction. There used to be an Academy Award for Best Story in addition to Best Screenplay. And this is one of the great stories. Just the sequence of events that take place in An Affair to Remember and Love Story, and to a lesser extent, the Warren Beatty version, is just really impeccable melodrama. Just punch you in the heart melodrama. And by God, if you feel nothing, you are nothing. When this story is told really, really well, it has a great impact. When it's told not terribly well, it can sometimes feel a little cheesy, but even then, it still works. Just because the tragedy that befalls these lovers is just so ironic and so unfortunate and so bitter. There's this great scene in Sleepless in Seattle, a movie which would not exist without An Affair to Remember, which is just all the women in the movie talking about how An Affair to Remember just destroys them even thinking about it. And it's because it's just a great tale.
Sleepless in Seattle is probably the way that I had heard about this movie. Mind you, I heard about Sleepless in Seattle using this movie, though I've never seen Sleepless in Seattle. It's on my list of things I need to watch at a certain point. And so for me, coming at this as a classic film fan, most people who know me know that I have some really big blind spots in stuff I haven't watched yet. Citizen Kane is again on that list of things that I probably should get to at some point.
Oh, have me on the show when you get to it. It's like my favorite movie.
I will, because I get told numerous times that that's enough to get my credit card revoked. I need to make time for it. This is a film that's been hearkened to like Romeo and Juliet. So many movies have borrowed elements from it. Obviously, the lovers who have people on the side trope. The way Leo McCarey does it, though, is very different. This was actually his third to last movie that he would make in 1957. He came back in 58 with Rally Round the Flag Boys, and then he ended in 62 with Satan Never Sleeps, and that was it. It's amazing to me to look at the films that Leo McCarey directed in his entire filmography. He had over 100 credits starting in 1921, and the man is just a master of amazing titles, whether it's Duck Soup or Ruggles of Red Gap or The Awful Truth or Love Affair. This movie to me felt a lot like Make Way for Tomorrow. Those two movies would feel very comfortable as a double feature. Mind you, you'd probably want to open a vein afterwards because they're just, they're gonna make you so sad. But where this movie is about youthful-ish young lovers who find a way to make it work, Make Way for Tomorrow is older lovers prepping for death and having to negotiate being separated. If you haven't watched Make Way for Tomorrow from 1937, go watch it and cry, because it's one of the most heart-wrenching, beautiful movies about the elderly that I've ever seen, but it will destroy you.
The movie I actually would go to for the double feature for this, is maybe I'm more of an optimist, is actually The Bells of St. Mary's, which is also about two people who clearly have a lot of affection for each other. In that case, it's Bing Crosby and Ingrid Bergman. They're both in the church. They just can't bring themselves. They're so dignified. They have so much pride that they can't admit to each other how they feel for a lot of the movie. He once again, as he does in An Affair to Remember and A Love Affair, in an effort to lighten the movie up, you get adorable ragamuffins.
Yes, we will be talking about adorable ragamuffins, because this movie has a scene stealer in that regard.
It's chock-a-block with ragamuffins.
Because you're an awesome person who does his homework and I'm not, you rewatched Love Affair the original with Irene Dunne and Charles Boyer. How does this compare to you? How does McCary essentially tell his same story twice?
There's a really interesting subgenre of movies of filmmakers who made the exact same movie twice. Hitchcock did it with The Man Who Knew Too Much. Michael Haneke did it with Funny Games. Leo McCary did it, and it's kind of shamelessly, actually. He uses the exact same screenplay. There's a few minor changes, but for the most part, and A Fair to Remember is longer. It is a bit more lush. It's in bright color. It's kind of more of a sweeping orchestral theme, which I think really helps the A Fair to Remember version. But really, what feels very interesting when you watch them back to back is that Love Affair is actually naughtier in a lot of ways, and it's owed entirely to Charles Boyer and Irene Dunne, who are enjoying the affair more than Deborah Kerr and Cary Grant are. Cary Grant and Deborah Kerr are a bit more mature in their romance. They're a bit more restrained in their affection for each other. Whereas Irene Dunne and Charles Boyer are very, very playful. And it even affects the last scene of the movie when the Charles Boyer Cary Grant character goes to see his former lover, and he doesn't know that tragedy has befallen her, and he's just so hurt that he finds this really passive-aggressive way to share his pain with her and make her feel bad. When Cary Grant does it, it just feels so grim and defeated and mean, and it hurts more. When Charles Boyer does it, you get the impression that he was just such a playful guy that this wasn't necessarily him trying to be painful, and you get the impression that he just gives up on the whole artifice of it halfway through the conversation just because they're so affectionate. In many respects, it's the same screenplay. It's the Delmer Dave screenplay and Phil Ogden's. It's every bit as witty, a lot of the same dialogue. But I think Love Affair is a little more spry, and even though An Affair to Remember is considered the classic, I think Love Affair, the original Love Affair, is actually a slightly better movie.
1939, when the original Love Affair came out, golden era of cinema, which we've talked about a little bit on the show, just so many titans of filmmaking came out in that time. Even though the production code had been ushered in by that point, you were still able to have this friskiness and a bit more frivolity leading up to the advent of the war. By the time this comes out in 57, so much of the world had changed, and you're getting the start of the 60s. The studio system's going to collapse in a couple of years. If you listen to my Cary Grant episode, Cary Grant was finding it hard to find his footing as a leading man as the 50s go into the 60s, which is why many of his 60s films have a lot of weird May December romances that we don't really acknowledge unless it's Charade. The 39 Love Affair is only an hour and a half. This movie is almost 2 hours. So does it feel, because I would say that for a movie that's nearly 2 hours, the first hour of An Affair to Remember literally sails by. It moves very briskly. I feel it slows down a bit once they get on land.
You know, it's so much more breathless in its attempt to get through the story and not run any risk whatsoever of boring you that, again, when you compare them, An Affair to Remember feels relatively dry. And I really do think a lot of it is the performances in terms of how it feels longer. Charles Boyer is convincing you that he is a playboy. And he does it with every scene. He's cranking up the charm full blast, and that's the character. The character is supposed to be so charming that he is literally famous for nothing else. It's kind of funny watching it now, just like, he's so famous for being sexy. Cary Grant, in An Affair to Remember, he's in his 50s. He is still as dapper as ever, but you get the impression that the subtext of the film is that he has had his playboy years, and he's ready to calm down. He is relying quite heavily on the baggage that being Cary Grant comes with taking this role. We know Cary Grant is the most debonair human being who ever lived. So he only has to remind us of it a little bit at the beginning, and then he can just be completely sincere and actually throw off that whole charming facade. And I think that's the idea, is that he's trying to be more genuine with Deborah Kerr. It works, but I think it also slows the film down a bit because it doesn't have that same intensity and that same frivolity.
That was the thing that caught my attention, even on the second viewing, because Cary Grant is starting to look his age. This is the era that I call the really tan Cary Grant years. It's hilarious. They introduce him as the big game hunter who's going to get married. And his job is that he's a professional playboy. Like, people want his autograph. And I started to wonder, what does he do? I guess he's essentially the male Paris Hilton. It's almost like the movie seems self-aware of that and sending it up a little bit, because it's abandoned very quickly and other characters are more invested in it than he is, which is going to William's point that Cary Grant, the persona, is starting to wear a little bit. And Deborah Carr, I'm not a big Deborah Carr fan. I think that to me, she's always felt very sterile, very prim and proper. If you've seen something like The Innocents or The King and I, which was her big success that led to her getting this film, she's great at playing schoolmarms. And it's not until this movie and something like Tea and Sympathy that she's able to break a little. And I really enjoy her and Cary Grant in this movie. This was the second of three films they made together. They did 1953's The Dream Wife, and then they did 1960's The Grass is Greener after this. And Cary Grant's persona gets tempered a lot by Deborah Carr's performance, which seems very unrestrained. Leo McCary said he loved having his actors improvise. And so much of the film is just listening to these characters, almost like watching the Before trilogy, you know, Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, Before Midnight, watching them just have these conversations and watching them discuss being in relationships and tear down their personas. And I'm a huge fan of that first hour or so on the boat, because it's watching these two great actors talk. It's almost like watching a master's class, and of course they're supposed to be falling in love, but their chemistry and the relationship and the way that they play off each other, coupled with composition and how Leo McCary directs, which we can discuss alongside it, that first hour is just beautiful.
Deborah Carr is an interesting figure because she was super famous, very important, and she's just not talked about very much anymore. And I think what's interesting when you look at her career is that a lot of her best roles and a lot of her best movies, you say she's a schoolmarm. I think you're right, but what I think is most interesting is watching her simmer underneath that persona. When you look at something like, well, From Here to Eternity is rather obvious, but even something like Heaven Knows Mr. Allison, where she is a nun who is trapped on a deserted island with a very rugged, never been more virile Robert Mitchum. And she hasn't taken her vows yet, but she still won't do anything. You're waiting for the movie to boil over, and will it ever? I like that movie a lot. Here, it's a love affair. It's not an extramarital affair because they're not married yet. One thing I think is interesting is that one of the few actual real changes between Love Affair and A Fair to Remember is that her character in Love Affair was simply sleeping with her boss. She wasn't actually engaged to be married. She said she thought they might go there, but then she's like, no, I guess I just sleep with my boss now. I don't know. Here she is very much being sort of pruned, having all of the edges sanded off of her so that she will be a good wife. And she's not. And she gets an opportunity to do so with Cary Grant. And there's just that one little extra element, which is they're on a boat, they're in public, there are wacky people around them who are constantly aware that they're probably having sex. I'm curious about this, because this is still a much more prim and proper era of cinema, and they couldn't come right out and say it. And even if they could, they probably would have had to say, no, they weren't having sex. Do you think the subtext throughout the boat ride in that first hour is that they're having sex? Or do you think they haven't even gone that far yet?
The movie has to walk a very fine line. There are little things that are included in that first hour that imply, no, these two characters are definitely not having sex, but they could. And a lot of that is told through watching the other characters react to them. So there's a wonderfully shot sequence where they're sitting on opposite ends of a wall at dinner. So they're together, but they're not together, and they don't know that the other person is on the other side, and everybody in the restaurant's laughing at them. The movie's trying to say that, well, everybody assumes that these two are having sex, but you get little things like the fact that they are both engaged to be married. Promises have been made. So by the studio dictates, they're definitely not going to. They're not in rooms long enough. think of that moment in Out of the Past where Robert Mitchum and Jane Greer are in a room together and then the camera just kind of like moves to an open door and then like time passes. That's supposed to tell you that they're having sex. You don't really get little asides like that here. It's just the fact that there's so much innuendo that other people are putting on them. So I think that had this been a more acceptable era, if this had been made the pre-code era, or even a couple years later into like the early 60s, oh yeah, they probably would have been flirting on the edge of actually consummating it. But the impression that I get from this movie is that no, everybody just assumes that. They want to, but they haven't.
Here's the thing. When I watched it originally, especially when I was younger, that was exactly my interpretation. Watching it again, I don't think the movie really works in my head as an adult who's had some experiences, unless they have. I mean, you look at what the film hinges on, which is this sort of sad twist of fate, this almost cosmic punishment that is thrown in their path. When Deborah Carr is a hip car and can't see Cary Grant at the top of the Empire State Building. It's hard not to look at that as some sort of production code, they must be punished for having an affair. And then when you backtrack a little bit and you think about when they go visit Cary Grant's grandmother, there's a moment where they decide to go into a chapel and it is the most awkward chapel moment. If you sense their guilt.
Deborah Carr's praying, Cary Grant starts to feign prayer. That's such a loaded moment where they're either atoning for sins or it's some mock wedding almost. They're sanctifying their union in some way. And I could definitely see that that's the illusion that I noticed a lot in this second viewing was there's a scene where Cary Grant jumps right on top of Deborah Carr in a swimming pool. He's in a bathing suit, she's in a bathing suit. I mean, if you're reading imagery a certain way, you could say they're in a pool. I won't get that much more graphic, but I mean, you could allude that it's an allusion to some sort of sexual encounter. So it's a possibility. Maybe Leo McCary is just way more subtle about stuff than I've given him credit for. Because The Awful Truth, if you've seen The Awful Truth, is also very lithe and flirts with being a little bit more promiscuous than it is. Now I'm starting to rethink the whole thing.
It's interesting because we think of this as a Leo McCary movie, and indeed it is. He directed it, he produced it, he co-wrote the screenplay. But I also think of this very much as Leo McCary in sort of a wrestling match with Delmer Daves and Donald Ogden Stewart, and they're all very different storytellers. It's really kind of interesting that they came together on this one. Leo McCary is a very classy, and even though he's sort of associated often with these sort of melodramas, he did also do Duck Soup. He was a genre filmmaker in a lot of ways. He'll do what you put in front of him. Delmer Daves is a melodrama master. It's cheese, but I think it's easy to sort of forget how significant it was at the time. But look at his A Summer Place. It's another one. It has that haunting theme. It's all about promiscuity and the punishments for promiscuity. And oh God, how are values failing us? But then you have Donald Ogden Stewart, who was this incredibly witty. He was a member of the Algonquin Roundtable. And he is just naughty and full of great wordplay. And he is pushing the boundaries in most of his writing of what is acceptable. Even though often he has to fall back on it, like the Philadelphia story. Well, of course she has to end up with the guy she originally married, even though she has more chemistry with everyone else. It's interesting to see that sort of interplay here, because we have a story that, on one hand, is about the thrill of the affair. On the other hand, is about people who are used to being promiscuous, trying to settle down. And then you have a story that is very moral in the second half. It's unfortunate for me, honestly, that I think the thing that kind of sours me on the movie a little bit today is that it feels like Deborah Carr's character gets punished way more than Cary Grant does. There's even that line, if something had to happen to one of us, why did it have to be you? And I'm asking myself that same question. Why did it have to be her?
I'm going to save that till the end because I have so many problems with the ending of this movie.
Fair enough.
And that is a huge part of it. Delmer Daves is one of those. I have a very love-hate relationship with his stuff. A Summer Place is one of those where you watch it, and if you've seen stuff like Peyton Place, you'll enjoy it. I don't think he's nearly as entertaining to me as Douglas Sirk, but A Summer Place is one of those really great weird movies. There's a subplot where I'm pretty sure Sandra Dee is talking about having sex and it's to her dad. Because, you know, that's not weird. He's tempered by Donald Ogden Stewart, and there are some great bits of dialogue between Deborah Carr and Cary Grant going back and forth. That great Spitfire 1930s-esque dialogue talking about the cigarette case and the whole sequence with the grandmother. Everything feels very lyrical, but it's also improvised, which I enjoy so much. We were talking about certain elements of the boat ride that I think are really good. Because again, I think the boat is the best part of this movie. The way these two are trying to carry on this affair in public. There's a lot of great dialogue, but there's also really unique shot composition, or at least the way characters' marks are hit when Deborah Carr is going down steps and they're going like in circles up and down the staircase having a conversation, so it doesn't look like they've met up with each other, but they have. And then Cary Grant starts talking and it's not to Deborah Carr, it's another person. Hands coming together. It's very in line with 1950s melodrama, but it has an added quality of uniqueness to it. Unlike other romance where it's all pining and swooning, these two have sexual tension between them that can be felt.
Well, you get the distinct impression that if they weren't seeing other people, they would simply have had sex. That would have been fine. And it all would have been okay, and it just bad timing. But going back to what you're talking about, the shot composition, I think it's another one where it's really interesting to see that Leo McCary did two versions of this film. And in the lean and mean love affair, all of this stuff on the boat has to just fly by. I mean, it's well staged, and obviously the actors are fantastic. But compared to the way it's filmed in An Affair to Remember, it feels a little bit more perfunctory. There's this one really funny bit. It's hard to watch it now, actually, because Irene Dunne and Charles Boyer are having a conversation in front of the ocean. And the ocean, by the way, is going really fast. It looks like they're on a speedboat. But it's also, you can't hear the ocean. And sometimes it's really jarring to watch older movies back when sound design was less full. And you realize now, it's like, they probably couldn't even hear each other in the real life if the gunshot was going that fast.
It's also really funny to watch certain movies and see either rear projection. They're probably standing in front of like a blue screen, or it's all layered. There's moments during the movie where you can feel that it's a studio set, which I don't think any of this was filmed on location. I think most of it was actually filmed in California. There are little things like that that don't really play to the film's strengths, especially in the latter half. We talked about cute ragamuffins. I have to talk about my favorite part in this movie that I didn't really notice the first time around. There's a moment where Deborah Carr and Cary Grant are having a conversation. They run into a little boy who's randomly stuck in the railing. He's just like sitting there by himself at night, unattended by adults. And he says he knows exactly who Cary Grant is because every time they bring him up, he has to leave the room. And he has this moment, they're all laughing, and he deadpans, "I don't get it." That scene is so hilarious because I want to know more about that kid. Like, what is he doing out here? Why is he on this boat? All these things. There's weird little subplots, like the guy that's trying to perpetually get Cary Grant's character, Nikki, his attention with his sister and his wife, and they just keep blowing him off. Little things like that that make it feel like they're not living on this boat in isolation.
Something that actually does benefit the new version. When the original love affair, that little kid is in love affair, and the scene plays out almost exactly the same, except Charles Boyer plays it even better, because when the kid says that, because every time they talk about you, I had to leave the room, and Charles Boyer looks like he's going to hit the kid for a second, and he thinks better of it, and he just goes, that's very nice, that's very sweet. That part's funny. When Love Affair tries to like add supporting characters, it comes across as really preachy and weird. There's this weird bit that isn't in An Affair to Remember, in which Irene Dunne is trying to make it as a singer. She's on her own. She's trying to like build up her life so that she can start a new life with Charles Boyer. And she is living with an older lady who hates her ex-husband who left her with a whole bunch of kids who hate her. And her whole argument, she goes on this big speech, and it's supposed to be funny because she's ironically happy, even though her circumstances are terrible. And she just says to Irene Dunne, okay, so just the moral of the story basically is, don't marry a shiftless layabout. Bye! And it kind of just seems a little unnecessary. It's like, we get it. That's not really the concern we have, is whether or not they're going to make ends meet. That kid sets up, however, a couple of things. The fact that they're able to have a pleasant conversation with a child, I think in one respect, sort of legitimizes their love. That it is the kind of love that they could potentially share with a child, and it wouldn't be naughty. This isn't just lust. They're actually just decent people. I think that's really important, and I think it also establishes that she likes kids so that they can have the cacophony of ragamuffins who emerge from the woodwork in, like, the second half of the movie when she gets a job as a teacher, a music teacher.
It also sticks the knife in further for that ending, too. Like, you start to worry about fertility. Is that dream gonna die? Again, I'm gonna rail on the ending of this movie when we get to that point. One of the side characters that we do get is Kathleen Nesbitt's grandmother character. She was only 15 years older than Cary Grant, but she plays his grandmother in this movie. Him and Deborah Carr go to visit her, and it's one of those moments that's why I tie it in to Make Way for Tomorrow, in terms of the fact that we're talking about, she's bringing up that they should celebrate their life together because visiting this location is what you do essentially when you're about to die. I think that that's a really loaded moment, but I like the way you get this. The whole movie is essentially like a woulda, coulda, shoulda type of thing. If they had made different decisions, if they had done things like this, that moment, even though it comes in the middle of the movie and you think that it would bog everything down, I think it leads to a whole transition in their relationship.
There's that legitimacy. This isn't just they want to do it. There's actually like a deep connection that they feel with each other that they've never felt with anyone else. Perhaps it's because they're able to not only acknowledge that they have these feelings of lust, but also that they've done it enough that they can acknowledge that there's more to it than that. Cary Grant, at the beginning of this movie, he has a phone call with some debutante he had slept with one time or something like that. And he's actually so rude, I almost don't like him at the beginning of the movie, because he basically just ignores all of her legitimate concerns, pretends there's a bad connection, hangs up on her, smirks and leaves. But he's not looking for that anymore. He's happy to take advantage of that, which doesn't make him a great person, I suppose, but we have these moments in just this brief courtship period where they interact with children, where they meet family members, where they have a religious experience together, and it just sort of serves to take the edge off. I'm glad you brought up the fact that his grandmother's only 15 years older than him, although my favorite example of that is actually in The Preacher's Wife, the remake of The Bishop's Wife, because Whitney Houston's mom in that movie is played by an actress who is 6 years older than Whitney Houston.
Yeah, oh my gosh.
That's hilarious.
I'm contemplating doing a remake original comparison between those two movies. The decision-making in that transition is just infuriating and interesting at the same time. Of course, half this movie takes place on a boat. They end up getting back to land. How do we feel about the transition once we get other characters? They've been talking about these two characters that they're about to get married to, and then we finally meet them. How do we feel about how the movie broaches its second half? I think it loses a little bit of steam, mostly because even though Ken and Lois, they're not bad people in terms of the fact that they're cheating on them or murderers. No big event to make you hate these two characters. It's just that they're not suited for the characters that we want to end up together. But at the same time, I also feel that they're really boring. And I know that's the point, but I think the movie loses a little bit of its edge.
The whole first half of the movie relies upon our protagonist's chemistry, and then the movie just throws them to different sides of the country, practically. That's why. Cary Grant doesn't have chemistry with anyone anymore. Deborah Kerr doesn't have chemistry with anyone anymore. And so we're eager for them to reunite, but I think that is something that particularly in An Affair to Remember, which is the longer version of it, where you can really overplay that hand. The bit in the movie where they separate, go about their business, try to build up their individual careers, and then try to reunite, that's a montage that has been unmontaged. And we're actually just seeing all the scenes play out. I appreciate you want to feel that distance. You want to feel, like the characters do, impatient for them to get back together. But there's a line, and arguably they've crossed it. And I think you actually bring up an interesting point. If their respective significant others that they were cheating on were more interesting, we might have gotten away with that. On the other hand, if they were more interesting, it might be a situation like you find in something like Scott Pilgrim versus the World, in which the other person in the love triangle feels like a more interesting relationship than the one the character is supposed to end up with. And you don't want that. And so you're kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't. I do think this is where we have the origin of the expression the Baxter, which I don't know if you're familiar with. The Baxter is a term that was coined by the movie The Baxter, which is the character in a romantic comedy in particular, or any romance really, who the protagonist is in a relationship with and leaves, not because they're bad, but because they're not interesting enough. And there's this inherent sympathy for those types of characters. The example, to bring up Sleepless in Seattle again, is Bill Pullman in Sleepless in Seattle. But we see it again in An Affair to Remember, and I'm sure that's where Sleepless in Seattle got the idea for that character. Because the guy Deborah Kerr leaves is really nice. He finds out she cheated on him and he's really sad, but then he sticks with her at the hospital and he's not pushing it and he's not trying to get back together with her. It's purely platonic and he's nice. It's refreshing, actually, to see that kind of character portrayed.
The Ken character is interesting to me because we're introduced to him via Deborah Carr's Terry telling us that he doesn't think I'm stupid, but he doesn't think I'm that bright, I think is what she says. So you do get that he talks down to her a little. As you brought up, he's pruning her to be this classy society woman who was once working in a nightclub. When she goes to buy clothes, she doesn't really want to be on his dime, and he feels that she should. And it's really progressive, I think, for 1957, that she's a working woman who doesn't want to be on a man's dime. Because if you do, that means 1950s domesticity. She's trying to reject that. She doesn't want to feel obligated. And I really like that that character is not trying to take him for what she can get. The Lois character, I think, in comparison, is a bit of a backslide because she's into publicity and wanting to be in front of the cameras, and he doesn't want to. You almost start to think, okay, well, we just need to do, like, legit swap here, because it feels like these are, even Ken and Lois would be better suited to each other. But I feel like Terry is given some more subtle shadings that's against the agenda of, like, the Donna Reed look that the 50s has come to personify. Which is funny, because Doris Day was considered for this character, as was Ingrid Bergman. And if Doris Day had played this, I think you would have gotten, even though I think Doris Day movies are progressive and subtly subversive in their own way, if you've seen them, I don't think it would have fit her to play this character who is has shades of wanting to be a more modern woman.
What you desperately need in this movie is someone who feels like they're on an even playing ground with Cary Grant. And Doris Day, whatever her skills as a performer, so much younger, so much more youthful in her approach to just the craft, that I don't think it would have played. I think it would have played, once again, it wouldn't have played like a guy who's settling down. It would play like a guy who just found another affair. I think that's the risk. Casting can be really, really dangerous in that regard. You bring up an interesting point, which is the idea that Terry is, at least for the time, progressive. And it's something that you run into a lot when you deal with classic movies, is that they were progressive for their time, but they're not progressive for now, or in this weird in-between place where they're progressive in some ways and not in others. And it's why it's frustrating to watch this woman who is eager for independence, who has strong enough character to prioritize the affair that will be better for her in the long run than the safe relationship that she has now. But then when tragedy strikes, she doesn't write him a note. That's the thing. Like, I understand, I feel bad, I don't know how to confront him, but you have the best excuse in the world. There's this thing, and it plays more in Love Affair, where she talks about how she doesn't want to tell him until she knows if she'll be able to walk again, and the implication is potentially if she'll be able to have children again. That element of, am I a quote-unquote ruined woman, is really gross, and it doesn't quite fit, in particular, this modern version of it, where she does feel so progressive. But again, it's right on the cusp of where that was something that you could only be so modern, or you were still fighting off these vestigial elements of sort of the gender wars and the gender dynamics, where that was a woman's place. And if you couldn't do that, you were less of a woman. And it's a little awkward, actually, to watch it now, and it's hard to necessarily sympathize in every regard.
Let's talk about the big twist of this movie, because I had heard about this movie's twist, which is one of the reasons I had sort of avoided it for so long, because I knew that it would probably irritate me. This is the Into the Woods, I say, ending, where if you've seen Into the Woods, the play or the movie, you know that The female character gets the worst brunt of punishment. She does literally nothing in the movie version. In the play, it's a bit sticky. Here, though, they're going to meet 6 months later at the Empire State Building. She is hit by a car crossing the street.
And she's right in front of the Empire State Building, by the way. She was right there.
Cary Grant's Nikki is waiting for her at the observation deck at the top of the building. He doesn't know. This is one of those movies that would be ruined by cell phones or social media. Because somebody would have been like, woman hit by car in front of Empire State Building. He would have known. But, of course, he doesn't know about the accident. He believes that she's just not coming. That she has decided to stay with Ken. And now Terry can't walk. And she doesn't want to contact him because she, again, doesn't want him to feel burdened or obligated. So she decides to teach delightful little children how to sing. And I am just sitting here flummoxed by this whole movie at that point because I knew it was coming. The third act, we're going to cripple her up. And I was just sitting there like, no. And I get, it's 1957, disabled people were not out and about. I get that if I was born in 1957, I would probably be in like a really nice state hospital. I'm lying, it would probably be a horrible state hospital, but it would be a hospital nonetheless. I had to shake my head like, Deborah, and we don't even know that she can't walk. We just are told she can't walk. So the rules of disability in that moment are purely for plot convenience. Because she's sitting a lot and he thinks that she doesn't want to talk to him, and he meets her at a certain point in time, and she's trying to hide this wheelchair like covertly until he says that he's going to be with her anyway. The lines she says is something, if you can paint, I can walk, anything can happen. I'm like, no, Deborah.
There's a great bit in Love Affair when it's the exact same line happens in Love Affair, and you can see Charles Boyer roll his eyes at that line where he's just like, well, it's a nice thought, but we'll make it work. I don't care. I don't care that you're paralyzed.
And my whole thing is, A, she didn't want him to feel like a burden, quote unquote. She doesn't have to take care of her, even though Ken has been taking care of her in terms of being a supportive person for her. So that's okay, but not this. I don't really get her logic there. And we're never really told what her issue is. She just has third act movie-itis, essentially. So there's no real rules or anything. So as a disabled person, I'm sitting there like, no, give me a diagnosis. I want to know what her issue.
They say like in like 6 months, we'll know for sure if you can walk again. I'm like, what?
I'm like, is her C7 gonna rebuild?
This is really complicated.
It's a lot like watching 1932's Jekyll and Hyde, which has a bizarre out-of-nowhere moment where this little girl, Frederick March, has taught her to walk. And she's just walking towards him, like shambling towards him with open arms. And it's like, he's healed the handicapped. That's how I took the end of this movie, was that love can make you walk again. And I was like, well, then I'm screwed. What has been happening here that this magically hasn't happened to me yet? I haven't found my Cary Grant, I guess. I get that it's romantic to some people, but for me, I have to laugh at the end. Because it's just so hammy.
It's hammy as hell. And honestly, that's a great, great point, obviously. But the thing for me, the one angle for me that I just couldn't quite get past is just, it's tragic that she couldn't make it to the top of the Empire State Building. It's tragic that she was in a car accident. It's tragic that she was hurt. The movie treats being handicapped like a karmic punishment. And I appreciate, obviously that sucks, she'd rather not be handicapped. Who wouldn't? I get that. But it's so rude what it's doing to the character and what it's saying about anyone who has any sort of handicap that it's just like, well, yeah, of course you'd worry that you weren't worthy of Cary Grant. Screw you! What the hell?
And I don't want people to think that this is a trope that, oh, well, this is 1957. This has not gone away. Deborah Carr is still beautiful in this movie. I mean, she's still fantastic. She's still got a great body. And we still see good-looking handicap people in movies all the time. And I've watched several movies that have disabled characters in the studio era. And men and women have different depictions of disability. I look at this and I look at something like The Best Years of Our Lives, which I know are two very different movies plot-wise. But Harold Russell's character, who is wounded in war and the actor is genuinely disabled, is able to navigate finding a job, living his life, finding a girlfriend, and navigating all of this with having no hands. Deborah Carr has some sort of inability to walk. For all we know, she could be Ricky Bobby and it's psychosomatic. We're not really sure. But she still is hobbled and it's horrifically detrimental to her. You start to question whether she can have children. I mean, she's still able to go to the opera and she gets really great seats. So, honestly, I'm not feeling too bad for her.
You're absolutely right. It's a good comparison, actually, I think, Best Years of Our Lives, even though, of course, they're very different films, because that is a story about a man overcoming adversity, and if I remember, it turns into a story about a woman dwelling on it and thinking that it ruins her. And yeah, it takes place over a relatively short period of time. It's like the first few months that it probably messed with your head and you have to get, I had knee surgery a while ago and that destroyed my ego, but like, I get it, but it's a movie and it moves kind of quickly. It's one of those movies that's all about like four plot points. You kind of just want them to get on with it. And the movie's ending, they're so committed to this ending, this incredibly melodramatic ending in which they are so full of pride and they're so hurt or worried that they've hurt the other person that they can't just talk the way that they used to. And there's an element of simple romantic tragedy in that, of people who used to feel like they could tell each other anything who now feel like they can't. But the machinations are so artificial after a while that, again, I think it works when you're more immersed in this kind of storytelling in the late 1950s or late 1930s, for example. Nowadays, it plays real heavy-handed. Like even, and it was heavy-handed before, but now it's just like, I don't even know what I can do with this anymore.
Well, and outside of Deborah Carr's character proclaiming the power of love is going to heal me, Cary Grant, his character is, no, I'm going to tell you that the power of love is going to heal you. We will make this work. I am a man. I will solve this. It feels very one-sided to me. It's not two characters coming together to talk about, this is a life-altering thing. Will we be able to do this? Again, The Best Years of Our Lives has characters discussing obligation and resentment and all these emotions, and the movie, because it's so close to ending, is just, nope, we're gonna deal with this, you will walk. And there's no indication at the end of the movie that she's not gonna walk again. That's my thing. The movie is pretty much saying, yeah, she'll be fine.
That's another reason why I like Love Affair a little better, is because it kind of leaves that a little bit more open. Like, I buy that they just might have to deal with it. And you think about it, when you think about how does this movie really end? Take away the artifice, and what happens to the characters? What is the last scene? The last scene is Cary Grant, on Cary Grant's side, Cary Grant finds out he wasn't rejected. And on Deborah Carr's side, she finds out that Cary Grant, she's still good enough for Cary Grant. And it's ironic that this movie is considered a so-called chick flick, even though it's really set up to show like kind of the awesomeness of Cary Grant by the end, and less so Deborah Kerr, at the very least less so in the second half of the film. And it's frustrating, and I don't think you could do it today.
And the sad thing is, we've seen disabled romances into 2017. I don't think we've come very far from 1957, from this depiction of it. So I would never say the ending of this movie is detrimental to An Affair to Remember. It's a great enough movie that I'm able to love it in spite of the flaws. But it does make me sad and heavy-hearted that in 60 years, we haven't really transitioned much in terms of disabled representation.
25 years ago, I was introduced to this film by my mom. I was quite young. And it played unironically. And now, you really have to take it in context. You really do. We've moved ahead so far in terms of the way we tell our dramas, in terms of what we expect out of romance in real life and in fiction, in terms of portrayals of women, in terms of portrayals of people with disabilities. That's the thing you have to think about whenever you read classic literature, watch classic movies. Context. Context is important. And you have to have these conversations, but you also have to remember, at the time, that's pretty good.
Love Affair was remade in 94, starring Warren Beatty with a screenplay from Robert Towne. It starred Warren Beatty and his wife Annette Bening. Katharine Hepburn is in this. I think it's one of her final film roles.
I think it was her final film role, actually, yeah.
And it was a notorious flop. I've never seen this. This was nominated as one of the Razzies aren't really legitimate in any way, shape, or form, but this was nominated as one of the worst remakes or sequels that year.
I rented it to try to watch it again with fresh eyes. I have seen it. I can speak to it sort of vaguely, but it's not based on I watched it yesterday and I can tell you all the details. If memory serves, it's very sincere, but it doesn't really bring anything new to the material. And I remember at the time, part, a big part of the narrative around it was, oh my God, Warren Beatty's so old. He's so old to be playing this. Like, they even made a joke about it on The Critic. Oh, and he's only like a couple of years older than Cary Grant was when he made this. Like, he was like about as old then as like Tom Cruise is now. This weird disconnect that we have. I mean, he's still older than Annette Bening, but still. I remember thinking it was a somewhat respectable attempt, but it plays a lot more to me like, you know, like when they remake a movie for television for no reason whatsoever?
Like Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah, Rosemary's Baby or the latest Dirty Dancing remake or whatever. And it's just like, you're going through the motions because you could. You don't actually have a new perspective to offer. You just kind of wanted to do it yourself. It's the dinner theater version of a better film. And they're not even doing something crazy like the Marlowe Thomas version of It's a Wonderful Life, where it's all gender swapped and weird. No, no, no. We're just doing Love Affair, but now Warren Beatty wants to do it with Annette Bening. And a part of me is like, okay, well, good for you, I guess. Do I have to watch it? Because this feels like more for you than it is for me.
And in cursory glance at the Wikipedia plot, outside of the fact that the Warren Beatty character has a different name and a different profession than Cary Grant's character in the 57 version, the movie seems to be predominantly a shot-for-shot remake.
They changed the beginning because people don't go by ship that often in the 90s. They were on a plane, and then the plane had the touchdown, and then
boom. Well, I was going to say, professional playboy, even though Warren Beatty would have won that in 94 with a bullet, I'm sure. No, that's not really a real job, if it ever was. I'm tempted to see how the ending plays for me, knowing that it was 94 and, like, disability had changed so much, but I'm sure it's still going to irritate me.
For all of our listeners, we set up the Ragamuffins, but we really didn't get into them.
Yes.
Like, we didn't jump into the pile of Ragamuffins. So, and when Deborah Kerr is on her own, she has missed Cary Grant at the top of the Empire State Building. She takes a job as a music teacher, and she teaches 2,000 orphans, is what it feels like. They all sing, and they all have weird voices, and the song has nothing to do with anything, and it goes on forever.
That felt almost like a callback to The King and I. And I don't know if that was the intent or not, but she had done The King and I the year before, which is a story of a woman teaching a bunch of precocious children. They just happen to be concubine children to a king. And the song goes on forever. The camera looking at, oh, look at these precocious children. Aren't they so precocious? Their precociousness is off the charts. I mean, it's great that they don't necessarily judge her as a person who goes through life with a wheelchair. Children are a double-edged sword for me. And we don't really necessarily see them being like, oh yeah, our teacher doesn't walk. Isn't that weird? But at the same time, you have to be mindful of the fact that, and again, I don't know if an able-bodied person would have necessarily taken it this way, they don't judge. Children are these innocent things that don't judge you for your flaws. Aren't they amazing?
Kids. Why do we keep shoving kids in the movies? And the thing is, you know what? I actually misspoke when I said that the song they sang doesn't have anything to do with anything. It does, and I wish it didn't. The song is called Tiny Scout. And it's basically about your conscience. It's all about how your conscience eats you up inside. And I'm like, so we're basically just rubbing it in?
Hasn't this poor woman been through enough?
And again, this is a scene that is in Love Affair, the original Love Affair. It's a different song. The song has less to do with anything, but it's shorter and it's catchier, and I think it was even nominated for an Academy Award. And she teaches kids, and she's good at it. And the kids like her. The end. We didn't need any more than that. We don't need to spend 25 minutes, is what it feels like. It's probably more like four. And they all have these, like, wacky voices. One of them, like, talks like this.
And it feels like they're probably all overdubbed by professional voice actors or something. It almost feels like you're watching that episode of The Twilight Zone that they couldn't use any of the dialogue, so they got June Foray to voice all the characters. It feels like a very hokey moment to remind you of, A, Deborah Carr's character is just saddled with guilt. Guilt at what? She didn't plan on getting hit by a car.
Even Ken forgave her!
Why are we making her feel worse about herself? And I think it ultimately seeks to remind you that if she's going to live a poor, barren, handicapped existence of sadness and pain and loneliness, like, at least she has these mock children that to console her at night. Again, I don't think it plays as well for me as it would for someone who doesn't read into film. So again, a casual viewer probably won't even notice this and think I'm just being mean for the sake of it. I'm not.
I think you're 100% right. And if I remember, it's really frustrating because, again, my mom loves this movie so genuinely, and I hope she hasn't disowned me by now. And there's a lot of things that really work about it. You know, Cary Grant and Deborah Carr have a really good chemistry together, and of course they're brilliant performers who've been brilliant in other things. Leo McCary is a talented filmmaker. The screenwriters are talented. We didn't even touch the song. A love affair is a love... It's a great... great, lilting, classy song. There's a lot of good stuff in it. In its construct, in the DNA of the story, there's a lot of iffy stuff that does not feel as fun or as acceptable or as easy to brush off as simply imagination of the plot as it used to. And as much as it would be nice to be able to just brush all of that off and just appreciate the good parts, you have to take the bad with the good, and there's some bad in here, and it's frustrating, and if you watch it, if anyone listening hasn't seen it, well, we ruined it for you, and we're sorry, you're going to notice this stuff, and I think you should, and I think we should have a conversation about it.
If you've listened to any of my podcasts, my Gone with the Wind episode specifically, or if you've read my reviews, I doubt I'll get as much vitriol for this as I did saying I hated Saturday Night Fever.
Ooh, ouch. I'll do you one better. I like the movie Staying Alive.
Okay.
All right, there you go.
Double-edged sword of watching classic films is having to deal with stuff that was once considered maybe not acceptable, but less frowned upon. I don't judge people who like Holiday Inn, but I have to ask them how they can deal with the very racist Abraham number in that movie. Those are the things you have to deal with. I love Ginger Rogers, but the plot of Kitty Foyle bothers me as much as it can. Those are the things that you just have to mitigate and turn your brain off and understand that that was just the time period. That doesn't mean that the movie's necessarily bad. It just means that it came out in a time period where that wasn't acceptable, and hopefully we've gotten a bit more progressive in that time. An Affair to Remember, I think, is a wonderful movie. I think it's worth seeing. I think that first hour is utterly astounding, and I love it so much. It's gotten me interested enough in seeing the original. I'm a big fan of Leo McCary. I think Cary Grant is great. Deborah Carr, one of the movies where I actually really enjoy her performance. I do say, though, that the ending of the movie will never not bother me, because I am a person who is privileged enough to have grown up in a time where hopefully I wouldn't have to hide my wheelchair behind a couch and say, no, I'm comfortable here. I'm never moving ever until you leave.
I definitely highly recommend the original Love Affair. And fair to remember, I think the pacing is just a little off, and I think they make a few little tweaks that just doesn't work as well. But if you've never seen the original Love Affair, and if you love classic movies, and if I remember, will probably play pretty darn good. You'll just run into some bits, particularly in the second half, where you go, okay. And you do need to do the double feature with Sleepless in Seattle, which is another movie which has elements that don't play as well today as they did just 25 years ago. But it's still very spry. It's still very likable. There's a lot of clever stuff in it. There's a very interesting meta commentary on the way that An Affair to Remember and old movies have changed the way that people look at romance in real life, and also the way that we look at romance in other films. So it's an interesting flick, and if you haven't seen that either, I do recommend checking it out. But again, you'll see some, you gotta take it with a grain of salt moments.
Listeners, let me know your thoughts on Affair to Remember. You can tell us that we are horrible people for criticizing it, or you can tell us that you love it, or any thoughts that you might have. You can email them to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and I will read them on the next episode. Once again, I would like to thank the fantastic William Bibbiani for joining me today. William, where can fans find and get in touch with you?
You can find my criticism mostly at craveonline.com. You can find my two podcasts. They're on iTunes, and I believe they're both on Stitcher, at least one of them is. It's Canceled Too Soon is the show where we review television series that lasted only one season or less. This week, we're reviewing the 1979's Cliffhangers, which is a very interesting sort of slate of mini television shows, including The Curse of Dracula, a sci-fi cowboy cowboy thing called The Secret Empire, and an adaptation of The Perils of Pauline called Stop Susan Williams, starring Susan Anton. It's really neat, and I can't wait to share that with people. So host the B-Movies podcast, where we review movies and talk to filmmakers and talk about movie news. And you can find me on Twitter, at William Bibbiani. Oh, also, I forgot to mention, Cancel Too Soon does have a Patreon page. We are trying to put together a lot of exclusive content for our subscribers, because that show gets expensive and really time-consuming because we watch an entire season of television every week. So that's patreon.com/canceledtoosoon, canceled with one L. Both spellings are okay, but we chose one L.
That's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. As always, you can listen to Ticklish Business a variety of ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio, or on iTunes. If you listen via iTunes, please consider leaving a rating and review. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Want to listen to episodes early, have me review your favorite film, even get a free classic film DVD? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go straight back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast. If you're interested in becoming a patron, just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Next time, you guys are getting a special bonus episode with special guests, yes, I said plural, Colleen and Nora Fiore, as we look at our favorite Maureen O'Hara movies. Until next time.